Hello and welcome to the Slightly Fox podcast from Hoxton Square. This is a podcast about lost and lesser known books and the art of publishing, and it comes to you from the kitchen table of this little independent literary magazine in East London. Now, last time we talked about bookshops and booksellers. We had the lovely Brett Wollstonecroft from Daunt Books and the even lovelier Kathleen Smith, formerly of this parish, from Toppings. And that podcast gone really well, hasn't it, Jenny?
Yeah, really well. It's always lovely to hear from listeners. And obviously we've had lots of people for whom those are their local bookshops saying, we're so thrilled that you've featured our own bookshop. But also from lots of people overseas who have said, I've either had those bookshops on my must-visit list and I've been, or I'm putting them on my list. So yeah, it's really gratifying.
It's really lovely. And all the podcast reviews are on the website, aren't they?
Yeah, so Anna and I have been working on a sort of podcast section of the website. You can read other people's reviews, you can look at photographs. It's definitely a work in progress.
But this time, Slightly Fox editor Hazel Wood has chosen a theme which is close to her own heart, and it's a professional interest, isn't it, as well as a personal passion, and that is travel writing.
Yes, I've always loved travel writing and done a little myself when I was working on the Sunday Telegraph. In fact, the first piece I pitched was a freelance piece. I went round England by coach, and it was a time when all the little coach companies had been combined and you just got one ticket. So I went round England by coach, which took a terribly, terribly long time, stopping off here and there with kind friends and obliging B&Bs, mostly in the rain, I have to say.
Well, it is England.
But in those days, you could be uncomplimentary in a travel piece, whereas now you have to say you've had a wonderful time.
Yes. My name is Philippa Lamb. Shortly, we will be joined by this month's guest. But should we get up to date with what's going on here at the magazine? Jenny, what's happening?
The summer issue was officially published on the 1st of June. So that's now reached most of our readers around the world. So, of course, it lands in England and Ireland and Wales, Scotland very quickly. And then it sort of starts to filter out to our far-flung readers.
Do you have a favourite piece?
There are a couple. One of them is a piece on Rebecca West's Saga of the Century, which is written by someone called Rebecca Willis. These books have been on my really must-read list for such a long time. And then, as is so often with Slightly Fox, this article sort of pushed me and said, you really must look these up. The first ones is available in a Virago Modern Classics. And then the next two are actually out of print. So I've got lovely Anna on a bit of a second-hand hunt for me, because she quite often does that for our subscribers.
Andy.
Yeah, perk of the job.
Hazel, is there a favourite piece for you in the latest issue?
Well, I did rather enjoy the final piece, which was actually a friend suddenly appeared from round the corner. She's a writer herself, and saying, you know, is this piece any good to you? She'd agreed with a friend of hers that her friend would try to read Wuthering Heights and she would try to read Sense and Sensibility, both of which books had kind of resisted them in the past. So she set about it and found it quite hard work, actually. I mean, she is a writer of magical realist fiction, so you can imagine that Jane Austen wasn't her sort of natural choice. But she got to the end and then discovered, in fact, that her friend had recommended Persuasion. So I enjoyed that piece.
Well, I've read the whole issue, and my favourite piece is, predictably, the Woodhouse piece. And Jenny, the office is full of bunting. What is that?
It is. It's very jolly bunting, and it's celebrating Independent Bookshop Week, which runs until the 22nd of June, which is this fantastic campaign that's part of the Books in My Bag national campaign, which is run by the Booksellers Association. And there's all sorts of things going on. So, you know, we've got bunting, but the bookshops are doing lots of other things, so events and signings. So if you're lucky enough to have a good local independent bookshop, do pop in there and see what they're doing. Or you can look it up online, follow the hashtag Indie Bookshop Week, or look up their Twitter or Instagram handles at Books Are My Bag.
Excellent. And Hazel, a new book out from Slightly Foxed.
Yes, well, we're doing what is in effect a prequel to a book we published last year by Eric Newby. And this one is called Love and War in the Apennines. Something wholesale, he marries his wife Wanda, and in this he tells how he met her. He was captured by the Germans in 1942, I think it was, and in the chaos that ensued after the Italian government surrendered to the Allies, he escaped being a prisoner of war and went into the Apennine Mountains. And he survived really with the help of peasants and farmers who laid their lives on the line. It's written in his usual rather sort of jaunty style, but in fact, he says that he never really recovered from this experience. But at that time, he met Wanda. Her family helped him to survive and ultimately to escape, I think.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, it sounds like a romantic fairy tale, but it was a very dark experience for him. It's a great book.
Yes, it is a great book and terribly enjoyable and moving, actually.
No, we have no Gail this time. I think this is the first podcast we haven't had any Gail.
Well, Gail's just having a break. She, as you know, Gail spends some time in Devon and she's...
Down with her dogs.
Down with her dogs, but she'll be with us for the next podcast.
Thank you both.
I was just going to say also that we had news this week of the closure of one of our favourite bookshops in Much Wenlock. So I was just going to say that if you can find it in your heart to buy your books from your local bookshop rather than going in and then buying them on Amazon, I would recommend that you do that.
Well said.
Hear, hear.
So, as I said, our theme this time is travel writing, and our guests are the travel writer, Sarah Wheeler, and Barnaby Rogerston of Elan Books. Now, appropriately enough, our reading from the archive this time features one of the great 20th century travel writers, Patrick Paddy Lee Fermor, and his books about that marathon walk he made back in the 30s from the Hook of Holland to the city he still rather romantically called Constantinople. As always, we will have book recommendations from everyone later on. And before we move on, I'm going to issue the usual caveat about noises off during the podcast. Jenny, builders, it's strangely silent.
Well, it's actually quite worrying because the builders have half installed a lift.
Yeah.
So we're not quite sure what's going on with that.
Okay.
My dog is here and he's in a particularly needy mood, so we might hear him whining.
And am I right in thinking there's a new dog in
there
the Slightly
is.
Fox
there
family?
There is a new dog, so we didn't have enough dogs already with the two Cocker Spaniels and a Whippet. So Jess, who is our newest member of staff at Slightly Fox, she has Dusty, who is great fun, and her and Tarka like to chase each other round and round the coffee table and make an enormous amount of noise, so she's actually not in today. We'll put a photograph on the website.
Yeah. Marvellous. Let me welcome our guests, travel writer Sarah Wheeler and Barnaby Rogerston of Elan Books. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's a short walk.
I'm glad to hear it. Now, Sarah, I mean, obviously, I think you're perhaps originally best known for writing about Antarctica. How did that come about?
Well, one book always leads to another, and I'd written a book about Chile, and that had been a six-month journey going from the Peruvian border to what I thought would be Cape Horn, but then I had to go over to what they fondly call Chilean Antarctica. And it's quite a struggle as a travel writer. You have to try and conjure the people and be honourable to them. So when I saw the Antarctic before me, I thought, there's no people. This is the place to go. Well, you don't have to worry about that anymore. And I thought, I'm going to write a travel book about being in the Antarctic, which nobody had ever done before. And I mean, had I known then how hard it was going to be to organise, but it's like waiting for a bus once you've invested a certain amount of time. You've got to keep going, haven't you?
So you were embedded with the US.
America runs the Antarctic like it runs the world, i.e. not officially, but it does. So they had to take me. And then if they took me, everybody else would have to. And that's what happened. So I was a guest to various national programmes, which doesn't cost anybody anything because you just hitch lifts on resupply helicopters and fixed wings.
And how long were you there?
7 months.
Is that a long time?
I could have stayed.
Really?
Yeah, gotcha. It's paradise on earth.
How did you prepare?
There was a lot of preparation. Medicals, trying to get fit and trying to organise. It's hard to go away for 7 months. And I suppose didn't really know what to expect. But I spent 5 months travelling from camp to camp, and the camps were anything from two scientists to 200. There was 200 at the South Pole. And then the last 2 months I had my own camp. I was the American government's writer in residence, and I had my own camp with the American government's painter in residence. And she had a much harder job because the paints froze. As did her fingers. So when we were trapped in the hut, we had two fish huts at that point. Both polar regions have a very short light cycle. You have 5 months of complete white, 5 months of complete dark, and then a month when you have a light cycle where everything happens incredibly quickly, like a tide coming in both ways. And we started our camp on the 20th of August, which was the day after the sun rose, and it's coldest at that time. And the coldest we had was minus 115 with wind chill. And you throw a mug of tea in the air and it tinkles to the ground, freezes before it hits the ice. And you see the Earth, the planet, before we mucked it all up. And the emperor penguins all toddle around and they don't have any predators on ice, so they're not afraid. So they come up and we got fed up with them long before they got fed up with us and hanging around our hut, looking at us all the time. You see what it could have been like between humans and animals. It's all idealism and what could have been, and you're seeing the ice melting before your eyes, and it is a lot like stepping off the planet. There's no gas bills, no telephones, no irritating boyfriends. There's just nothing. And that's very beguiling, I think. And it's also incredibly beautiful. But then you've got all the historical components of the Golden Age. This camp I was telling you about was right next to Scott's hut from his last expedition. So we used to go in there. And in fact, I slept the night on Scott's bunk, much to the fury of everybody when I got home. And the keepers of the flame, they all said, well, if you do it, everyone's going to do it. I said, there's nobody for 10,000 miles.
It's not like you just pop over on the
And yeah, so I laid there and you listen to the stones hitting the window, which they always do in the polar night, and think what it was like for those waiting for the ones, you know, that never came back.
I do. Before we go any further, I need to ask what that strange noise is that I'm hearing, because this is not a noise I've heard before in the office.
I'm so sorry. It's actually Tarka, who has hay fever, and he has these sort of extreme snorting fits, and he actually hasn't had one for ages, so he's really picking his timing.
I thought it was the printer.
No, it's not, but actually Jess has been a darling and has taken him out.
A seasonal difficulty for the podcast. Now, Barnaby, tell us about Elan Books.
Elan Books was created by John Hatt, as a maverick figure who worked as a banker for a bit, worked as a rep, worked as a journalist in Southeast Asia, and came across this extraordinary book called A Dragon Apparent by Norman Lewis. And he found it out of print, but found it explained everything that the French, the British, Australians, and especially the Americans should know about Vietnam. So he went around from publishing company to publishing company saying, you've got to reprint this book. Not only is it funny, but as it entertains, tells you everything you need to know about the history and the people and the complexities of Vietnam. And no one picked it up, so he said, sod it, I'm going to set up my own company, which he did in 1982, and publish A Dragon Apparent. And Norman, I'm delighted in, because I also fell in love with him as a young man, is writing, and he cuts right across the normal obsessions about British travel writing that is done by sort of posh public school boys like myself. But Norman had a very, very tough childhood in Enfield, local school, bullied, father's local chemist. And he sort of fought for his right to write. And then he started, you know, adding to the list about four books a year. Then we slowly move it up to eight.
And this is travel writing in its broadest sense, isn't it?
Yes, it's not about the self. It's not about glamorising yourself in extreme situations. It's about trying to understand other cultures. We like to think about it as sort of anthropology light, concentrating on a community.
So I'm interested in the trajectory of travel writing and how it's developed. Because it used to be largely documentary, didn't it, really?
It did. There's sort of, in many ways, the golden age of travel writing for a travel writer was before the rest of us could afford to travel. And so the notion of the armchair traveller. Think of people now pretty much dead in the eyes of us, a modern readership like Sir Cheverel Sitwell, who was a great Mandarin art historian, going around explaining with wonderful visual language cathedrals, mosques, architecture, terraces, you know, landscapes, which we don't really need because we've got film and, you know, access to things now.
And it evolved, what, around the time of the Second War, would that be fair to say, into a different direction?
Quite a lot of what is written before 1960s is distastefully racist, ethnic-centred, sort of books that you really don't want to sort of touch.
With some honourable exceptions, of course.
Fantastic exceptions, which we're lucky to rootle out. And then there's a period of mass tourism.
I mean, Hazel, thinking back to the 30s, I know Lee Fermor's a big favourite of yours.
As you know, we all came from John Murray at one point, and of course Patrick Lee Fermor was one of their authors, and I never actually met him, but he was sort of legendary for his inability to deliver. There was a constant conversation about when the next manuscript would be arriving.
And was he as charismatic as he's supposed to have been?
Well, he was said to be. Of course I never met him, but his charisma kind of hung around.
in either.
I did have the good luck of meeting him, and he was rather dazzling.
Was he?
Not in a showy-offy way, because he was dazzling in a way that all good travel writers are. They're interested in other people. And he sparked off conversations. Even in old age, he was really interested in picking up other people's stories and not letting off about himself.
What do you think actually are the essentials for a good travel writer?
To be able to talk, but much more important, to listen. You've got to have a good memory. You've got to have a selective memory, so you get rid of the dross. recounting holidays is not what travel writers do, is they cut to the quick and they sort of intensify the experience.
A travel writer's a bit of a breed bred in adversity, I wonder. When I think about quite some of the better known ones, was it Freya Stark who was so very ill when she was a child? And
well, the funny thing is, a lot of people who achieve greatness in any field turned out to have been incredibly sickly children struggling against adversities. And explorers also. People like Shackleton and a lot of the great polar explorers were extremely sickly children. Mallory.
Isabella Bird was sort of sent abroad for her health, wasn't she?
Absolutely. Pale and hopeless in Edinburgh amongst her polite society.
And she rose like a phoenix and galloped across the steppes of Colorado.
Because there were a number of famously intrepid Victorian female travellers, weren't they, doing things that they couldn't have done in any other field.
Who was it who said, count the blessings of a good tweed skirt? That was Mary Kingsley. That was Mary when she fell into a swamp in West Africa and the leeches were like frills around her neck. And she fell. And there was a hunting trap down, so it was a 4-foot spike up her skirt. And she said, it was fine. The blessings of a good thick skirt.
So do you think these women really did want to go and explore, or were they just desperate to get away from the fetters of Western European middle class
society? I think probably
society?
More of the latter than the former, but they had the get up and go to do it, plus a little bit of economic freedom. Although if you reeled off a list, which I could do, of all those Victorian tweed skirts, very few of them would have had what we would call a privileged background.
That's interesting. I had not understood that. I thought they were largely upper middle class.
Toffs. No.
Fanny Parks, actually, for instance, was married to the man in charge of the ice stations in 19th century India. Not a great prestigious job.
A fairly minor civil servant.
Very minor sort of works department civil servant. And she, on the back of this marriage, and she obviously found her husband very, very boring, but she wrote the greatest early 19th century description of India by anybody, let alone man or woman. The Eden sisters are, of course, right at the top of society. They were literally the sisters of the Governor General of India. As well as the role of writing books, you've got to have the audience to buy it. And I think India still is a place of fascination for the British.
So if we think that biographical travel writing's evolved, where is it now? More about the personal experience?
We have had quite a lot of that. In particular, we've had a lot of flit lit.
Sarah particularly hates books that have got a fit young white man with his shirt off on the cover, who's had quite a lot of television experience, and I think it might have got something to do with that. That's just
that it's true what Barnaby says, but Flitlet is moving to a sunny land and doing up a decrepit cottage, and a bloke comes in with a beret, bearing a bottle of red.
Oh, yeah.
Provence, Tuscany, Peter Mayle, absolutely.
We've had a lot of Flitlet. And things do, regrettably, always go in phases, don't they? I think in answer to your question in all seriousness, of course, memoirs staged a resurgence. So that has merged a bit with travel writing. And we've got a lot of the redemptive narrative, going somewhere to get over some terrible thing or to
eat, pray,
get
love.
Over your, even your, you know, not a terrible thing, but your children leaving home or something or other.
Mending yourself by travelling.
Correct, yes. And I'd like to think that that's gone full circle. I always say, I very occasionally teach travel writing, and I always say you've got to be very careful about how much of yourself you put in, and less is better than more. Yeah. I mean, look at Bruce Chatwin. There was nothing. You couldn't have said a single thing about him. And yet you know
Chatwin.
Him because you see the world through the prism of his vision.
For people who don't know Bruce Chatwin.
Well, let's talk about the most famous first line of a travel book ever published, When I Was Young in My Grandmother's Cabinet, which is how In Patagonia started. Now, my question to Slightly Foxed is, was there a grandmother's cabinet and was there a piece of skin in it? What do you all think?
I think it's called Truer Than True.
Yeah, there wasn't. He made it up. And that's okay. I mean, everyone hates it when I say this. They say, well, did you make anything up? No.
She says hastily.
But it's a work of literature. I mean, there's a truth that's truer than the truth.
Why does Chatwin speak to us so compellingly? Because the first time I ever read anything by Chatwin, it is extraordinary.
He worked at it. It's slim and boiled down, and we're probably going to disagree, but I think the books that really will survive for Bruce Chatwin are his fiction. On the Dark Hill, about those two brothers caught in the Welsh hills.
A wonderful book.
Utz, about that extraordinary history of Central Europe.
Another interesting point that you've raised there, that I'm interested in, as a non-fiction writer, I believe that writers are either fiction or non-fiction, you're born that way. And there's very few writers whom you could say, actually, that's not the case, they're just as good in fiction or non-fiction. He's one. Let's think of some others.
Leonard Woolf created those two extraordinary things, a memoir of a decent liberal colonial officer, in Sri Lanka, and then a novel written by a villager, which, and they have no reference to each other. Graham Greene, brilliant fiction writer. His travel, not so good.
Yes, I hadn't understood Thackeray, he tried his hand out, but it wasn't great, was it?
No, it wasn't great.
Because all the travel writers of the generation above me, they all write novels, none of them are any good. The reason they do it is they think fiction's a higher calling. I get it. Fiction is a higher form of writing than non-fiction in many people's imagination.
So travel writers want to evolve into literary fiction writers?
They can, can't they? I mean, our dear friend Colin Thubron, who's a brilliant travel writer, is always trying his hand with fiction and generally not considered to be as good.
Steinbeck, he was one of the few. Travels with Charlie, which I think is brilliant. Going around America in a camper van with his dog. And we can agree that he's a good fiction writer.
Norman Lewis, who I revere as a...
His novels weren't that great.
Novels not that good. And they get too colourful, they get too sort of painterly.
Yeah, he's exactly what I'm talking about. All of them are the same.
Although, I suppose with some travel books, you do feel that there's a big element of fiction in them.
Well, Norman made up everything.
Yes.
Norman did not.
He did. The most absolutely brilliant biography of Norman Lewis, who's almost one of my top heroes, by Julian Evans. And I remember talking to him when he was about 3 years in, saying he made everything up. How am I going to purvey that? And you see him in the biography, tying himself into knots going through this.
I think we're exaggerating. There's one incident where a bomb went off in a cafe 2 days after Norman sat at it, and he condensed the time, so he's a little bit close to the explosion. I've bought the diaries and journals from his widow, and it's fascinating seeing his greatest work, Naples 44, which is a sort of fictional 30 years sort of memory back. So undoubtedly he's using his head memory, because he wasn't allowed to keep a diary as a sergeant in the intelligence corps in the Second World War, but they're very small notes, and that seemed to click things off. And it's very interesting how often a really great travel book is not an exact decoding of the travel journal. It's unfolding something that happened 30 years ago.
Almost always, I would say.
You always mistrust too much direct speech in a travel book.
Yes, and it's very... I was talking to Jonathan Raban. He said anything worthy of putting in a book is seared into your memory anyway as a travel writer. So you don't really need to worry about the journal. If you have that fantastic conversation on the banks of the Mississippi or fall in love with a mysterious woman in St. Louis.
Passage to Juno, about sailing a boat from Seattle up to Juneau. And his wife is due to meet him in Juneau and comes with their daughter. They meet and he can see something's wrong. And eventually she tells him that she's leaving him and she and the daughter go home. And he'd provisioned the boat for them. And the next morning, and this is the thing about the killer detail, he said, "I was eating Fruit Loops for breakfast." Which, of course, you'd only buy Fruit Loops for a child. And the child had gone. I mean, you could write 10 books on grief.
Yes.
And not get as much into those two words.
Economical. Is this thing about stepping into a different life, albeit temporarily, really central to the appeal of being a travel writer?
You mean leaving that place called home?
Yeah. And those people called home.
I think there's something about anonymity that adds a lot of fuel to the fire.
Do you miss it if you don't do it, if you don't get away?
Oh, I do, but that just, I mean, it never goes very long before I do.
Tell us about your new one. It's out. It's soon, isn't it? Is it July?
Yeah, July. It's about Russia. It's called Mud and Stars, which, as you know, is a Turgenev quote. "We sit in the mud, my friends, and look at the stars." And it's travels in Russia, with my guides being the writers of the Golden Age. So basically Pushkin to the death of Tolstoy. The idea really at the outset was to find out what had changed between then and now. Turns out to be nothing.
Unfortunately.
Ghastly then and ghastly now. People battling on, as they always have.
What's Eland up to now?
Eland is up to its normal mission of reviving great books that have fallen out of print.
And then
we fall in love with things that are pointed out to us. For instance, beside me on my left, Sarah wrote probably about 3 years ago a piece about Moritz Thompson's last memoir. This is an extraordinary, heroic American war hero, very, very wealthy man, did his own farm and then gave it all up and joined a Peace Corps and then plunged himself into helping very, very poor Ecuadorian farmers. And he wrote several books out of it. And then Sarah pointed out a book that we'd never heard about called The Saddest Pleasure, which is a culmination of all of this life experience and just savagely good. And we finally will have that ready this summer.
Well, we must move on, but it's such a fertile patch, this, I think, for exploring lesser-known writers. It's extraordinary, and forgotten writers. And obviously, you can find details of all the books
and all the writers that we mentioned in that discussion on the show notes of the podcast, and they will be on the Slightly Fox website as well. Let's hear this month's piece from the Slightly Foxed archive. Jenny, what have we got?
So this is a piece from a back issue, issue 38, and it's Patrick Leigh-Fermor's classic travel trilogy, but which of course was not finished by him in the end. And this article explores A Time of Gifts and then Between the Woods and the Water. And if you don't know Patrick Leigh-Fermor or haven't read him, then this should be a great introduction.
Few people living at the time would have regarded the early 30s as a golden age. In 1933, the Japanese invaded Manchuria. Hitler became Führer of the Reich, and the first stirrings of the Spanish Civil War were felt in Catalonia. But for one man at least, the cold months of 1933-4 provided a still moment in time, which he would remember with fondness for the rest of his life. In late December 1933, Patrick Leigh-Fermor set out on foot for Constantinople, as he anachronistically termed it. Recently expelled from school for the unpardonable crime of holding hands with a local girl, and insufficiently inspired by the prospect of Sandhurst and a career of peacetime soldiering, the 19-year-old decided to head east on foot. His backpack was evidently stuffed to the brim, with a greatcoat, jerseys, shirts, including white linen ones for dressy occasions, nailed boots, a selection of stationery, a copy of the Oxford Book of English Verse, and the first volume of the Lob Horace. The clothing was soon lost, but was replaced as he headed east by many generous donations from hosts and acquaintances. The literature was a more permanent part of his baggage. Although he lost his Oxford volume, this was complemented by a vast corpus of writing in English, French and Latin that he had committed to memory. A little over a year later, the young traveller arrived at the Golden Horn. Writing the account of the journey would take much longer. The first of three projected volumes, A Time of Gifts, was published in 1977, when the author was 62. The second, Between the Woods and the Water, which traces the journey from the Hungarian frontier to the Iron Gates in Romania, came in 1982. The third book remained unfinished at the time of the author's death in 2011. Between the long adventure itself and its eventual publication, Patrick Leigh-Fermor had led an improbably rich and full life. He was famous for his wartime heroism in occupied Crete, where he lived as a shepherd among the resistance fighters in the mountains, and masterminded the daring abduction of the German garrison commander. In the decades that followed, Leigh-Fermor produced some of the finest travel writing in English. His published books included a seminal study of the Caribbean in The Traveller's Tree, a reflection on the monastic life in A Time to Keep Silence, and two remarkable books on Greece, Marni and Rumeli. He was a lifelong friend and correspondent of the Duchess of Devonshire, and a selection of their letters, published as In Tearing Haste, is itself a delight. Without doubt, Patrick Leigh-Fermor was one of the great English prose stylists of the century. Much has been written about him since his death, and each of his books has its own admirers. But for those new to his writing, there is no better place to start than with A Time of Gifts and Between the Woods and the Water, as an introduction both to the young man on the brink of a great adventure and the mature writer at the height of his powers. While both shine through in these two books, it is the former who strikes the reader most forcibly. Almost immediately, we are confronted with the extraordinary personality of the young man who wanders across their pages, and it is easy to imagine how this spirit must have charmed and delighted those with whom he came into contact. Many of the most memorable passages concern not the towns and schlosses of the Rhine and Danube valleys, although these are effervescent in their own right, but the inhabitants who pass the time with the traveller during happy days and long evenings. His was a well-populated road, from the two German girls in Stuttgart who swept him into an exhilarating tumble of drinking, singing and Christmas parties, to the lugubrious Frisian in Vienna, who shared his poverty and some ingenious schemes for generating money before disappearing into the murky world of saccharin smuggling on the Middle Danube. And these are some of his less remarkable social successes. By the time he reached Middle Europa proper, Leigh-Fermor had become the darling of the fading imperial aristocracy. We read of raucous games of bicycle polo on the lawns of castles, of horses borrowed for a few days' ride across the great Hungarian plain, and a seemingly endless succession of benevolent Anglophiles who welcomed the dusty young traveller with food, alcohol, and the free run of their libraries. Even if we sometimes feel a tinge of envy at the ease with which the young Patrick drifted into this traveller's inheritance, it is hard to begrudge him it. The same easy charms that won over the inhabitants of Central Europe in the 1930s can still delight a reader 80 years later.
That was an extract from Andy Merrill's piece about Patrick Leigh Fermor's books, A Time of Gifts and Between the Woods and the Water. And it was read for us very kindly by the writer-producer Chris Neal. I hadn't remembered there was such a gap between him doing the travelling and actually writing the books.
No. It's another instance of what we're talking about, of using your memory. He lost the notebooks, and so he had just the resource of his mind.
One book, which he always said after that turned out to be the best book because of that, which I kind of completely get.
Yep, certainly. Because he had the notebooks for the final trilogy, which Colin Thuber...
He lost the notebooks for one book.
And that's not nearly as good, rather plodding. And what I remember feeling rather annoyed as a young man reading Between the Woods and the Water, thought this is just very easy drifting from one aristocratic house to another. But it's only when I got it in context, realising that he was writing that when all this had been destroyed by communism. There's that wonderful line, what's the difference between Central Europe now and the world that he passed through? He said that the Nazis murdered the Jews, the gypsies, and the communists killed the aristocrats. He was singing the songs of people who had gone. Then I went back to the book and just so enjoyed it. Well, before, I really sort of felt like kicking it around the room.
Yes, it did actually make me want to read it again, hearing it read aloud.
And Jenny, I know you went to Budapest, didn't you? And you saw one of the places that Leigh Fermor stayed.
I did. I actually joined a friend of mine, Katie McMillan-Scott, who is actually retracing Patrick's journey. And she's done the first two legs of it. And she's doing it in memory of a dear friend of hers who died of bowel cancer. And there's a chap called Tibor von Berg who has a house in the castle district of Budapest, I'm not quite sure.
Yes, thank you. Choice.
And his daughter still owns it, and she welcomed Katie and I there and showed us around. And I've got this recording of her talking about her father's memories of hosting Patrick and photographs of the room where he stayed. And so if anybody's interested, I will try and put those on the website as well.
Excellent. Yeah. Oh, thanks for that.
Elegant and entertaining, Slightly Foxed is the literary quarterly for nonconformists. It introduces readers to all those wonderful books that languish on publishers' backlists but disappear from bookshops. Its contributors are established writers, journalists, and people from many fields. They all share their passion for particular books and authors. And since it's entirely independent, Slightly Foxed is free to follow its own nose and celebrate the offbeat. So why not take out a subscription? Happily, it's a bargain. £48 for a year's print subscription and free access to all the back issues in the digital archive. Here's the web address, foxedquarterly.com. Or if you'd rather talk to a human, give Hattie a call. She's on 020 7033 0258. Thank you.
Recommended reads, everyone, please. Barnaby.
I'm a publisher, and so I'm not going to do the log rolling, plucking out one of the really deserving 8 books that Elan were reviving this summer. But I'm going to talk about Tim McIntosh Smith, who is a great travel writer and a great linguist. And he's just written a history of the Arabs, both their language and their civilization. And it's an enormous, threateningly large volume. But I learned so much and was so enchanted. And he's got this wonderful irreverence and enthusiasm for language. I think it's the most extraordinary, exceptional work made by someone who's literally in Sana'a in Yemen, having to endure civil wars and death all around him. And arguably, perhaps he would never have finished the book unless he hadn't been sort of caught in a sort of siege situation for the last 3 years.
And it's called?
It's called The Arabs, published, I think, by Yale University Press. Because he is a brilliant Arabist, he's got translations throughout the book. Every page has got some, whether it's the chants of an Arab spring or whether it's a sort of erotic poet from the 9th century. He gives you access to a culture that unless you've got his sort of skills, no one else can offer.
Hazel.
I like to recommend a book which is, it's not a travel book really, it's a book about exile. It's called Lost in Translation by Eva Hoffman. Eva Hoffman grew up in a Jewish family in Poland. Her parents had hidden throughout the war in sort of terrible circumstances. and she had her early years in Krakow. The first part of the book is a wonderful evocation of growing up in this pretty repressive regime. I mean, it was a sort of client state to the Soviet Union. Life was a matter of ducking and diving and surviving, but it was tremendously kind of rich in Jewish culture. And then in 1957, I think it was, restrictions on Jews leaving were lifted, and most people went to Israel. But her father was sort of seduced by an old business colleague who said that life in Canada was just milk and honey. So she found herself in Canada. And it's really about the sort of shock of leaving this European culture for this shiny, new sort of teenage culture in Vancouver. And also losing your language and how the sort of associations of language in your mind are so important, and the images that they produce and the sounds that you make. She became a different person than the person she would have been, perhaps, growing up in this very European culture. And also it sort of rang bells for me with the whole Brexit business, I have to say, casting off from Europe and all that it kind of means.
Sarah?
I'm going to pick A Woman in the Polar Night by Jenny Ritter, which was published in the 30s. And she was an Austrian woman who went on to become a very distinguished painter, in fact. Her husband had been on a scientific expedition in the far north of Norway and stayed on. And he asked her to come up for a year, and she did. And it was her husband and one other bloke, a hunter, who was there, and there was a constant anxiety which sort of runs throughout the book like a threnody of protein, vitamins. Could they get the stuff? And the reason I like this book is that it's a tremendous combination of a small amount of reflection about solitude and what life's like when it's stripped back to its essentials, and the practicalities of how you manage, particularly when the night comes in. Women's voices are heard very seldom in the polar regions. And what's noticeable about it is that she doesn't perceive the Arctic as something to be beaten into submission, like another mammoth outside the cave, that all those blokes these days who do it, you know, have photographs of themselves with their beards frozen up on the cover. They're beating it into submission. It's about conquering.
Winning.
And making records and all the rest of it, which I just think is the most colossal bore.
And this is about coexisting.
And it's about, yeah, she is just right about going there with no preconceptions or no ideas. Struggling, a bit of fear. Very little about the relationship with her husband and this other bloke. And she comes to that understanding that you, in all the best books about extreme environments, just the tranquility of merely being.
Tell me what it's called again?
It's called A Woman in the Polar Night. It's just being reissued by Pushkin Press with a very distinguished introduction.
You're raising an eyebrow there.
Did you do the introduction?
That's why it's on my mind. I just reread it.
Jenny?
I thought that I would just recommend a couple of my favourite independent travel magazines.
Yeah.
There's one called Lodestar's Anthology, which is really nice. It dedicates each issue to a different country. So the editor gets in touch with a whole host of writers, photographers, illustrators, lots of them actually from the country they're exploring, and then a small handful who actually go there from here. And there's another one called Rucksack, which interestingly actually started as an online journal. It built an enormous following to this beautiful website with huge glossy photographs, and you know, web can give you a space to publish this sort of stuff without the constraints of print. And then they've now gone into print. It's beautifully produced. They're both great magazines to add to your collection.
We need to wrap up this month, but before we go, thank you again to Sarah Wheeler and Barnaby Rogerson. You can find details of all the books we've mentioned today in the show notes attached to the podcast, as always. You'll find that on your podcast app or, of course, on the website, and that's foxedquarterly.com. We will be back on July the 15th with a podcast about garden writing. Thank you for listening and for joining us on another literary expedition off the beaten track.